Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This episode of the Charlie Kirk Show is brought to you by our great friends at ExpressVPN. Look, this is a service I use all the time. I use it on all my devices. It secures my data. It's ExpressVPN. I'm sure you think cybercrime is something that happens to other people. You may think that no one wants your data. That's just not true. Hackers, they can get your passwords, and they can get your credit card details, and you need to protect yourself. That's why I use ExpressVPN. It secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. ExpressVPN has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. As I'm working my computer right now, I've got ExpressVPN on both my phone, my computer, and my iPad. Turning on ExpressVPN protection only takes one click. I could safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped on or having my personal data stolen. For less than $7 a month, you can get the same ExpressVPN protection that I have. So right now, ExpressVPN is, believe it or not, the number one VPN service by TechRadar. Comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Right now, protect your online activity today. Find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/charlie. That's expressvpn.com/charlie for 3 months free with a one-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/charlie to learn more. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of The Charlie Kirk Show. Wow, a lot happened this weekend. I was in London visiting our Turning Point UK folks and doing some speaking. I interviewed Nigel Farage. That'll be an upcoming episode of The Charlie Kirk Show. And there's been so much coverage and pandemonium around Iran. So I want to dedicate this entire episode to President Trump's comments on Iran. This is a flash episode of the Charlie Kirk Show. Kind of what's going on in Iran. We're going to go through the history of the U.S.-Iranian relationship and exactly what's behind that and what led us to this moment. I think that's really important to dive deep into the history to find out some of the failures of U.S. foreign policy, some of the successes of U.S. foreign policy, and some things that we can learn and draw on from the last couple decades of decisions so that we can make more informed policy choices moving forward. So let me read directly from our great president's Twitter feed. Then we'll analyze that a little bit of exactly what's going on in Iran. So on June 21st at 8:03 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, so 11 Eastern, President Trump tweeted, quote, President Obama made a desperate and terrible deal with Iran. That's totally true, by the way. President Trump continued, gave them $150 billion plus, in all caps, $1.8 billion in cash. Let me just stop right there. This is exactly right. President Obama made a desperate deal with Iran, and it's still getting uncovered exactly some of the negotiations behind it, some of the potential corruption behind it, some of the back channeling behind it. President Obama loaded up an entire plane, $1.8 billion of a private plane of cash, sent it to Iran. Very questionable. President Trump continued in his tweet. Iran was in big trouble, and he bailed them out. That is also correct. President Trump said, gave them a free path to nuclear weapons and in all caps, soon. Instead of saying thank you, Iran yelled, death to America. That's exactly right. Iran, from the floor of their government, it's hardly a representative government, but of their government, the people that represent the decision-making process chanted, death to America. President Trump continues on the tweet, I terminated the deal, which was not even ratified by Congress. That's also true. Treaties have to be ratified by Congress. That's one of the first things that the Founding Fathers put into the United States Constitution when they formed it, is the ratification of treaties. Because back then, as similar today, but even more back then, you were not supposed to make any sort of treaty with a foreign nation. And one of their fears was, well, what if a president gets elected and they go back and make a treaty with the horrible, tyrannical England we just fought a bloody revolutionary war against? We don't want that. And so the fact that the Iran nuclear deal was never ratified by Congress is really, really scary and horrifying. And could you imagine if Trump, President Trump, would have put forth any sort of treaty or any sort of deal with a foreign nation with maybe, let's say, the country that's been kind of in vogue lately, Russia? Could you imagine the Democrats' outrage if President Trump never went through Congress? Yet Obama never went through Congress to get it ratified for the Iran nuclear deal because technically, quote, it wasn't a treaty, when it really was. It was a nuclear deal arrangement. President Trump continued on his tweet, they are a much weakened nation today than at the beginning of my presidency. This is exactly correct. Iran has total economic crisis right now. Unemployment is at record high levels. Inflation is increasing because President Trump put forth strong sanctions, sanctions that were completely appropriate. We'll dive into that in a second. When they were causing major problems out the Middle East, but now they are bust, President Trump says. On Monday, they shot down an unmanned drone flying in international waters. We were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night on three different sites. When I asked, how many will die? 150 people, sir, was the answer from a general. 10 minutes before the strike, I stopped it. Not proportionate to shooting down an unmanned drone. I am in no hurry. Our military is rebuilt, new, and ready to go. By far the best in the world. Sanctions are biting. And more added last night. Iran can, quote, never have nuclear weapons. Not against the USA and not against the world, in all caps. This is one of President Trump's greatest foreign policy decisions. I'm going to tell you right now what I believe happened in there. Now, I don't have inside intelligence and I don't have any sort of inside information, but I can make a pretty sure to kind of logical argument of what happened, because this is what happens with so many other presidents, is that this unmanned drone gets shot down, which, by the way, is a byproduct of Iranian desperation. It is a byproduct of Iran scrambling to try to regather the support of their people. You have to understand, there are protests happening in the streets of Iran daily. The youth in Iran, Iranians under the age of 30, they reject the current Iranian regime. They reject the current supreme leader. And we're actually going to go into the entire leadership structure of Iran and how they are actually structured, because it's quite fascinating and really, really important. And so Iran right now is in a very precarious situation, large in part thanks to President Trump. Under President Obama, they were doing quite well. They made a good deal for them, but a bad deal for the world and a bad deal for the West, where they signed this Iranian nuclear agreement, where they said, yeah, sure, we'll sign this thing and we'll have quote-unquote open inspections. By the way, they violated basically every part of the Iran nuclear deal that President Obama brokered with them. And in exchange, the United States would lift sanctions. And in exchange, the United States would send over $1.8 billion in cash. So the Iranian economy started to do a lot better. But what's a byproduct of the Iranian economy doing quite better? Iran is the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Iran is the number one state sponsor of terrorism. They fund weapons, safe havens, and training for actors such as Hezbollah in Iran, Hamas in Gaza, and other Palestinian groups like the Islamic Jihad, which is acronym PIJ. You might see it on the BBC or international news. And also the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command. PFLBGC is what its acronym. These groups are designated terrorist groups by the international community, by the United Nations. And so Iran will send hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in weaponry and funding to these organizations. But since the sanctions have been put on by President Trump, since the tough sanctions have been put on by President Trump, the flow of money from Iran to these horrible terrorist groups has diminished, decreased, if not disappeared. These terrorist groups are no longer swimming in cash anymore. In fact, Hamas, now, which of course is they occupy the Gaza Strip. One of the worst decisions Israel ever made was to get out of the Gaza Strip. Did you know 10,000 Jews were forced to leave their house in the mid-2000s, houses and in their kibbutzes? They were forced to leave their places of worship and leave their settlements, if you will, in Gaza in pursuit of peace. And what happened? Hamas, an Iranian-funded terrorist organization, took over the Gaza Strip. And so these sanctions that have been put forth by President Trump are working. Iran would not be trying to bomb carriers in the Strait of Hormuz. For those of you that don't know, the Strait of Hormuz is a piece of water in the Persian Gulf between the Gulf of Oman and the Persian Gulf, where a large part of the world's oil is transported through. And the two countries that essentially intersect it, you have the UAE, you have Oman, and then you have the entire Strait of Hormuz there, and then of course you have Iran to the north. And Iran will sometimes, and they did this throughout the 70s, they did this throughout the 80s, they did this throughout the 90s, they'll go and they'll cause trouble in the Strait of Hormuz. Essentially, they'll go sometimes put forth very questionable military tactics towards carriers that are going through the Strait of Hormuz. And so what just happened is Iran now shot down an unmanned aircraft. Now, they're desperate. What are they really doing here? Well, since there is chaos on the ground in Iran, since there are protests happening in Iran right now, since people are scrambling, the leadership in Iran is scrambling for power, they are trying to create a rallying call against the West. They are trying to unite their people, say, hey, see the Americans? The Americans are attacking us now. You see the West? The West is attacking us right now. And if America were to attack them, they would have an argument. So these generals probably walked in and gave President Trump a variety of options. Now, you must understand, there are many people within the Trump administration, in the State Department, and on the National Security Council that, quite frankly, are advocating for regime change in Iran, that their outward position is regime change in Iran. And they even have certain plans to have a massive ground invasion into Iran. Now, I'm not going to name any names because I've met some of these people and I consider some of them friends, but you can go connect the dots for yourself. Some people in the National Security Council and the State Department. And I'm positive that many of them would be perfectly fine with a ground conflict with Iran, which would be a horrendous mistake. And we'll make that argument in a little bit. That some of these advisors are putting forth options that eventually could reasonably lead to a war with Iran. And so they put forth some of these airstrikes and some of these Tomahawk missile strike options to the president. I'm sure the president looks at them and he asks a very simple question. Well, how many people are going to die? So thank you, President Trump, for asking this question. Thank you. Because it seems as if, based on the account that President Trump has tweeted and has given, that information was not being immediately provided. And so 150 people, if America would have killed 150 Iranians, we would be in a war with Iran right now. That is a reasonable assumption. If 150 Iranians would have died in response to an unmanned air drone being shot down, which was worth about $150 million, which we can retaliate using sanctions, not missiles, then we would be in some form of a conflict with Iran. Not to mention that Iran has terrorist cells all across the world that could have hit soft targets, such as embassies, such as public places in America. Iran being the number one funder of terrorism around the world, they have an entire network that they can retaliate in unconventional ways. And so the president kind of thinks to himself, brilliantly, by the way, President Trump brilliantly thinks to himself, wait a second, why would I go kill 150 Iranians because they shot down a drone? It seems as if Iran wants to draw me into a conflict. It seems as if Iran wants to put me into this sort of back and forth with them. Almost they want war, that they want the drums of war. Let's slow down. I'm in no rush. That's exactly what he put on his tweet, as President Ronald Reagan used to say, let's have peace through strength. And President Trump pauses and says, I don't want to escalate this conflict where American lives might be put in jeopardy, because no American lives have been killed by Iran in this conflict. They have in the past, and we'll talk about that. And Iran has definitely been a bad actor in many ways, Iran being the number one state sponsor in terror. And President Trump says, I'm just going to put sanctions on. I'm going to wait patiently. This is absolutely brilliant. And it's something that, of course, the media gives him no credit for. Instead, on CNN, I could not believe this clip. I heard this on the Rush Limbaugh show, and I have to play it for yourself. Only President Trump could get Democrats who pretend to hate war to love war when President Trump actually wants peace and President Trump goes forth against war. And so, do you remember Mayor Rawlings Blake? Do you remember former Baltimore Mayor Rawlings Blake? Her most famous quote was when she, you know, let's actually play the soundbite, Mr. Producer. Let's play the soundbite back in 2015 when she made the argument that her protesters needed space to destroy. Do you remember those horrible Baltimore protests? Do you remember when Baltimore was basically on fire? Do you remember when Baltimore was, businesses in Baltimore were being burned? When dozens of beautiful small businesses, laundromats, you name it, are being burned? But the mayor at the time, Mayor Rawlings Blake, said they needed space to be able to destroy. Let's listen to that sound.
I've made it very clear that I worked with the police and instructed them to do everything that they could to make sure that the protesters were able to exercise their right to free speech. It's a very delicate balancing act, because while we tried to make sure that they were protected from the cars and the other, you know, things that were going on, we also gave those who wished to destroy space to do that as well.
So yeah, that individual, former Baltimore Mayor Rawlings Blake, she somehow got onto the Jake Tapper show, and she was brought on in a quote-unquote expert with Iran. Now, maybe she has some foreign policy credentials that I'm unaware of. Maybe she was a former CIA operative. I don't know. So maybe there's something I'm missing, but it wasn't explained in this segment. And so she goes on CNN with Jake Tapper, and she gets asked about Iran. And she says something along the lines of, well, a president who talks tough all the time and then finds excuses for Iran, that's not acceptable. Let's play the sound now of just in this last week of Mayor Rawlings Blake on CNN.
We can't have a president that talks tough all the time and then finds excuses for Iran, which everyone is clear. They said they did it. They did it on purpose. We can't sit back and act like it was anything else. You can't allow people to keep poking and poking and poking without having a response.
So there you go. So the Democrats, they pretend that they want peace. Now, mind you, they said they brokered the Iranian nuclear deal because they want peace. This is the same community of individuals that said, oh, yes, we need peace with Iran. Yes, we need to be sympathetic with Iran. We can't go to war with Iran. Now, look, let me make something very clear here on the Charlie Kirk Show. You can think Iran is an evil country, which I do. You can think Iran is part of the current modern axis of evil. You can think Iran is a horrible country while also believing you should not go to war with that country. What an amazing concept, isn't it? You can believe that you actually can dislike a country. You can believe a country is evil. You could believe a country should be repudiated and sanctioned without wanting to go to war with them. And it seems as if we're in this binary world where either you want to send them billions of dollars in private planes, either you want to lift $150 billion in sanctions, either you want to appease them at every turn, or on the other hand, you want to do a 100,000-person ground invasion of Iran, which is completely foolish and wrong. And so the Democrats now are saying, oh, Trump is indecisive. Trump doesn't know what he's doing. Trump, which of course he does know what he's doing. He's keeping us out of a ground war with Iran. And so I want to take a step back here. And I love going through history at the Charlie Kirk Show here. And people are the feedback I get from people, they're so happy when I do this sort of history. And I think this is actually really important because this history is not really talked about. Because the United States and Iran have a very complicated history. And I'm going to say it right now that we have made mistakes in our decisions towards Iran. I'm going to go through them. Here's why I'm a big fan of SimpliSafe Home Security. SimpliSafe is ready for anything that gets thrown at it. If a storm takes out your power, SimpliSafe is ready. If an intruder cuts your phone line, SimpliSafe is ready. Say they destroy your keypad or siren, SimpliSafe will still get you the help you need. Here's what I love about this. Maybe it's overkill. Maybe you don't need to be ready for every worst case scenario, but SimpliSafe is always ready, just in case. That's what makes it so great. Now SimpliSafe could cost an arm and a leg. It should, but it doesn't. And that's because they're good people. They charge you what's fair. I'm telling you, this company's terrific. You got to use it. What's right? $14.99 a month. No contracts, no hidden fees. I recommend SimpliSafe to everyone I know. You've got to check it out. Go to simplisafe.com/Charlie. I use it. You've got to use it. Simplisafe.com/Charlie. It's really important to realize the history because this will give you a lot more context right now and then also moving forward. And so many of you have heard about the Iranian Revolution of 1979. But in order to understand the Iranian Revolution of 1979, you have to go back a little bit. And so just so you understand, Iran is really Persia going back 2,500 years. A couple quick facts about Iran. Over 81 million people live in Iran. It is the 18th most populous country in the world. It is the as far as its square mileage or its square kilometers, depending if you're listening to this internationally. It is the second largest country in the Middle East, and it's 17th largest country in the world. So we're dealing with a reasonably sized country here. Now, Iran is effectively Persia, and many of you have heard of the Persian Empire in the past, and the Persian people are very wonderfully entrepreneurial, innovative people. And I think it's really important to draw the distinction between the Iranian people and the Persian people and the evil Iranian regime. And so many of you have heard of this, the Shah of Iran. And I get questions, Charlie, what exactly has gone into Iran? Well, let's go through the history now. So the Shah of Iran was the heir to the royal family of Iran, which again was effectively Persian, not Muslim going back 2,500 years. This is really important. Persia/Iran predates Islam. Islam came far after the Persian Empire. As Islam was growing, especially the modern Shia form of Islam, which is really important to remember, that Shia There's Shia and Sunni. Shia is a minority of believers in the Islamic faith. Iran is a outward Shia regime, whereas Saudi Arabia and many of the other Arabian Peninsula practicers and followers of Islam are Sunni. Sunni is the dominant sect of Islam. There are some theological differences between Shia and Sunni. We're not going to get into that right now. We could do a different show on that. In fact, I might have Dr. Zudi Jasser, who's trying to fight for an Islamic reformation and a modernization of Islam, really support what he's doing. Because I have some great friends who are Muslim and that are fighting for that. And I think they do some terrific things. And I really support kind of the reformation of the faith of Islam. And Dr. Zudi Jasser does a brilliant job of that. It's really important to remember that Persia is not married to the idea of Islam. Is that it's actually separate, and I'll tell you why. And so the Shah took power in 1941 when the Axis invaded and tossed out his father. So the Axis obviously included then Nazi Germany, Benito Mussolini's Italy, and of course Imperial Japan. And so they invaded Iran, they tossed out the father, and then the Shah took power. And the Shah played a really important role even to what we're experiencing today. And so the Shah's name was Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. Now, he's just usually referred to as the Shah. And so he was largely a secular figure. And now, Iran had a form of government that was essentially that of Britain's, or it was supposed to be. It really wasn't. Had a parliamentary system that elected a prime minister. The monarchy was supposed to be like Britain, which essentially was a flag waver for the country. But in reality, the Shah wanted all the power. He wanted to run the place. And so things were rather docile and stable. But then a big turn happened. Oil. Oil was discovered in the Middle East and everything changed. If it was not for the oil in the Middle East, if it was not for the discovery of oil in Iran and Saudi Arabia and all these other countries and Iraq, many of these conflicts would have been completely avoided. This part of this region of the world would be basically ignored. It's all about oil. It always has been about oil. So going back then, the United States had an oil company based in Saudi Arabia, and the British had one in Iran. So the Saudis got tired of the Americans essentially controlling their oil, and they insisted that the Americans started sharing their oil revenue. This was decades of arguing. Then finally in the 1950s, post-World War II, the Americans relented and they agreed to share part of the money with the Saudis. This really led to the rise of the House Saud, which is, of course, you get the term Saudi Arabia. This led to the rise of many of these billionaire oligarch families in Saudi Arabia all across the Middle East when the West decided to share some of the oil profits with the native countries that actually owned the oil. The Iranians looked at what happened in Saudi Arabia and they said, wait a second. Hold on a second. Why do the Saudis, who are Sunni and we're Shia, why do they get all this money? Why do they get to have beautiful, brilliant palaces? We're living here in a much lower standard of living. They went to the Brits and they went to the British and they said, wait a second, we want you to share too. And the Brits said, yeah, I don't think so. So that really started a lot of conflict between the Iranians and the British. So 1951, the Iranian prime minister, who was a nationalist at odds with the Shah, he nationalized the Iranian oil industry. The people loved it, but the British and the Americans hated it. So understand that all about oil, but the nationalization of Iranian oil led to the people being very happy that they thought there was going to be more wealth and more prosperity, and they might be right. The nationalization of oil, it has worked in certain countries. It's failed in other countries. It's worked in Norway. It's failed tremendously in Venezuela. Nevertheless, so essentially what happened then, the British and the Americans, because they were upset that Iran nationalized their oil industry, which meant that the West would have less supply of cheap oil, overthrew Mossadegh. It wasn't easy, and it actually led to an order to abandon the operation from Washington. Think about this. There was actually an order to abandon the operation from Washington because it was so messy. And it literally was ignored by the CIA Iranian bureau chief. The CIA, with the help of the British, ended up toppling Mossadegh, and the Shah, who was in exile, returned and assumed control of the country. So Mossadegh got overthrown, and the Shah went back into power. Now, this overthrow, it's really important, was a mistake. We never should have executed this overthrow. This overthrow, looking back, really led to a lot of the resentment of the United States and Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East. This was the point where a lot of the Middle East points to today, and they say, you remember the Americans doing this? You remember the Americans doing this? Now, Americans actually denied involvement in this for decades, declassified documents in 2013 actually did indeed show that we were instrumental in the overthrow of Mossadegh. Now, he was a nationalist populist. There's nothing inherently wrong about that. I mean, I disagree to some of his policies, but really putting the Shah back in place led to a lot of discontent and a lot of disruption. And it sowed the seeds for something far worse. And so the Shah, he ended up being a pretty good American ally during the Cold War. He got very, very powerful, egotistical, and ruthless. But look, the Persian, not Muslim policies he put in place and the practices made people very, very unhappy. But the Shah did institute a lot of reforms that are pointed to today of how Iran got modernized. I mean, it was labeled under the idea of the White Revolution. But look, it didn't turn into the United States. There was no middle class, a ton of disparity, and lots of anger. And so you had the Shah kind of ruling as a dictator, and there was still a lot of resentment. People said, wait a second, what happened to Mossadegh? Why don't we go back to how things were? And even though things were getting better, there was still resentment because people did not want to live under the same ruling class, the Shah, which is the direct heir from the Persian Empire 2,500 years earlier. And the world is becoming more Western, and people are becoming rather upset, and it really sowed the seeds for what became known as the Islamic Revolution. So by the 1970s, the secular intellectuals decided they could get rid of the Shah if instead of resisting the religious Muslim rulers, they embraced it and worked with it. This was a huge mistake. And so the secular intellectuals were really impressed with the writings of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. You've probably heard that before. He was exiled from Iran since 1964. And so the match that really lit the fuse for the revolution was the 1978 article in a newspaper harshly criticizing the Ayatollah. People immediately took to the streets in riots and protests, and it just kept growing. The mob kept growing all across the country. The Shah was really sick at the time with cancer and indecisive of how to best handle the mess. Similar to kind of the recent revolution that you've seen, the Arab Spring, a lot of these dictators have no idea how to handle this stuff. They just don't. Now Carter was president, so the U.S. was not really going to help at all. Carter was rather indecisive, and some would say even weak. I think Carter was a nice enough guy, but I think he mishandled this. So ultimately, the Shah is forced to flee. So the Shah is forced to flee to the West. He kind of bounces around a bunch of different countries, and he eventually gets to New York. And once he gets to New York, and it's showed that the United States is giving harbor and safe asylum to the Shah, this is what led to the longest hostage crisis in recorded human history, the Iranian hostage crisis, where the Iranian revolutionaries stormed the United States embassy. They took 52 United States diplomats and citizens, held them for 444 days in the United States embassy in Iran. Now, of course, the first day that Ronald Reagan takes the presidency, Iran releases all the hostages. It's funny how strength versus not strength, weakness, some would say, is kind of juxtaposed. And so that there's only been two supreme leaders of Iran. So there's only been two supreme leaders of Iran, which basically this is a dictatorship. They say they have elections. They don't. They're a complete farce. And so the first supreme leader of Iran and the intellectual founder of modern radical Iran is Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. He died, and now the current supreme leader of Iran is Ayatollah Khomeini. Again, I'm mispronouncing these names. I'm sorry. So anyway, so today, Iran operates similar to a caliphate. It has a council of guardians, which basically are just sycophants to the supreme leader. There is an elected president and elected parliament, but the caliphate decides who is able to run. It's just a show. This is a Sharia law country. And a law, they do blow some smoke around some of their secular laws, but it's all a bunch of nonsense. And so that's where we got to today. And so to kind of go back in that history super fast is you had the Persian Empire, you had the Shah, all of a sudden there was a dispute about oil, nationalist at odds, Mossadegh decides to nationalize the oil as prime minister, the West doesn't like that, again it all goes back to the oil, we execute to the CIA an overthrow even though we say don't do it, it gets done, this leads to massive deep-seated resentment, a lot of that resentment is still a rallying call against the West, which then of course the Shah does an okay job, even though people don't like him. Shah gets overthrown. Shah comes to the United States, and that leads to this radical Islamic dictatorship that we have now that is the number one state sponsor of terror through the West. And of course, our mistake of overthrowing Masagde and putting in the Shah 30 or 40 years ago, 50 years ago, however long it was foolish. But that's not an excuse for Iran to continue to be a bad actor. So I hope that kind of background is really helpful kind of going into the current state. And so of what's going on right now. So Iran being this horrible state sponsor of terrorism, Iran having a pretty sizable military and poking around the region, President Donald Trump says, wait a second, why are we sending billions of dollars to them? President Donald Trump says, why are we lifting $150 billion in sanctions to them? President Trump says, hold on a second, we're going to put sanctions on them. We're going to hold tough against them. And now, look, President Trump has been very clear about standing against endless wars in the Middle East. President Trump ran asymmetrically against the Bush-Clinton agreement that America should be an endless war in the Middle East. I fundamentally disagree about that. I fundamentally disagree that we should always be in the war in the Middle East. I think the Iraq War was one of the worst foreign policy mistakes in American history. I think the Iraq War was one of the most disproportionate responses. I think the Iraq War made us weaker. I think the Iraq War made us more financially unstable, and I think the Iraq War was a horrendous decision in every single capacity. And President Trump was highly critical of the Iraq War. Here are some fast facts about the Iraq War. 460,000 people died in the Iraq War. That counts civilians, that counts American troops. 60% can be directly attributed to violence, the other 40% famine and relocation, so on and so forth. You look at how many people died of violence, it's horrendous. Right now in America, 1 in 4 vets struggle with PTSD. There are so many vets every single day committing suicide every single day from what they saw in the Middle East. 40% of the Iraqi middle class fled. That's right, 40% of the Iraqi middle class fled after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which left it a very, very vulnerable country. 4,424 American soldiers died in Iraq. 4,424 sons and daughters, nieces and nephews, husbands and wives died. Fighting for what? We'll go back in a second. And over $2.4 trillion were spent in Iraq. And so President Trump has been highly critical of these endless wars in the Middle East, especially with Iraq. And so if we go back to the Iraq War, really what triggered our re-involvement in the Middle East was 9/11. 9/11 was the worst terrorist attack against and on U.S. soil in American history. Over 3,000 people died. 4 planes were hijacked. The Pentagon was attacked. 2 towers in New York, and of course, Flight 93, which was on way to Washington, D.C., crashed in rural Pennsylvania. And the heroes of Flight 93 will never be forgotten. But Iraq did not pull off 9/11. For those of you that follow my work, for those that follow exactly, you know, how I talk about this, 15 out of 19 of the hijackers were Saudi Arabian. Another was Emirati, another was Lebanese, and another was Egyptian. And so if you were to make an argument of a country that actually had a heavy involvement in 9/11, it wasn't Iraq and it wasn't Afghanistan, it was Saudi Arabian. In fact, bin Laden is a very wealthy family in Saudi Arabia. The bin Laden family is one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia. And some would argue, going back to what I talked about with our oil relationship with Saudi Arabia going back to the 30s and 40s, our relationship with Saudi Arabia is what caused us not to actually hold Saudi Arabia accountable for their involvement in 9/11, for what they did in 9/11. And if we actually want to get the 9/11 First Responder Fund to be funded correctly, John Stewart has been brilliantly lobbying for that in the last couple of weeks. Why didn't Saudi Arabia chip in? Anyway, and so I think our war against Iraq and our war against our conflict in Afghanistan to a lesser extent, but the war in Afghanistan has been going on far too long and far too costly, has been a complete and total disaster. And so we invaded Iraq as a disproportionate response to 9/11 when we really should have held some of these other countries accountable. In some sense, we shouldn't go to war. I'm not saying we should have went to war against Saudi Arabia, but we should have held them accountable. We shouldn't have continued to purchase all this oil at a very favorable rate to them. They should have had to pay some sort of retribution and prove that they were held accountable for 3,000 Americans dying on our own soil. And then, of course, we go then invade Iraq, spend $2.4 trillion, lose another 4,000 American lives, and destabilize the entire region. And then what happens? ISIS comes up in 2011, 2012, We have the weak president, Barack Obama, who does absolutely nothing when Iraq starts to rise. They take over Mosul. They take over parts of northern Iraq. Now, do you actually know what ISIS stands for? It stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. That's what it stands for. That doesn't get very much coverage very often, but that's actually what the acronym stands for. So ISIS was actually able to rise because we took out Saddam Hussein. Now, Saddam Hussein was a really bad guy. He was a horrible dictator. He killed many of his own citizens. But again, if the United States is going to be permanently in the business of regime change, we're going to go back to what we did with taking over Mossadegh, putting in the Shah, and sowing resentment against an entire country that wants to then obliterate us with Iran. And again, I'm no fan of Iran, but I'm also not a fan of playing war games all throughout the Middle East while our country is $22 trillion in debt. We lose thousands of American citizens fighting these wars, and we further destabilize the region. If we think we can implement democracy in this part of the world, we're incorrect. A constitutional republic just is not going to work in many of these parts of the world today until there is a true reformation of Islam, until democratic capitalism is allowed to be implemented and neoliberal policies are able to spread. And so anyway, ISIS comes to rise thanks to Donald Trump's more decisive foreign policy action. ISIS has now been completely and totally destroyed. But we have to understand right now, as things are with Iran, and some people are pushing for a war with Iran, wait a second, they're already on the ropes. They're already struggling. They already are not in a comfortable position. They would not be shooting down drones if everything was great in Iran right now. Tens of millions of people in Iran are rising up and protesting. People are marching in the streets like you wouldn't believe. And at one of these times, it is going to crack. One of these times in Iran, the regime is not going to be able to continue their population control. And just from a simple oil-producing standpoint, we don't need the Middle East anymore. Do you know who the number one oil producer in the world is right now? Do you know who the number one oil producer in the world is? The United States of America. 15.3 million barrels a day, followed by Saudi Arabia with 12.2 million barrels a day, followed by Russia with 11.4 million barrels a day. Then Canada, which is a friendly trading partner with us, 5.2 million, and then Iran, 4.7 million. So the argument that we need the oil, which is never explicitly made by some people, the warmongers, but it is implicitly made at times. We don't need it anymore. We don't need to be in the Middle East. We just don't. Now, we should, when appropriate, help our allies such as Israel or help joint coalition forces defeat ISIS, which we did. But instead of playing these endless war games, these the drums of war being beat of a full-fledged ground invasion of Iran, which, again, what happens here, and this happened in the Gulf of Tonkin with Vietnam, is you have a singular incident such as an aircraft carrier being bombed or a ship at sea being bombed, and then the temperature gets raised and the rhetoric gets raised, and all of a sudden 150 people might die if we launch missiles, and then they might retaliate, and 1,000 Americans might die. Next thing you know, you're in a full-fledged ground invasion against that particular country. And look, Iran is not our friend. Iran is our bitter and horrible enemy. And so do not misunderstand what I'm saying is that you can be pro-American, which I am. You could be pro. Of course I'm pro. Let me rephrase this. You can be anti-Iran and also anti-war. War is not the answer here. The idea of America being perpetually put in these foreign endless wars. By the way, we've been in Afghanistan for 20 years. What does success look like in Afghanistan? What does it look like in Afghanistan right now to actually be able to achieve victory? Can anyone tell me that? No. I mean, we're fighting wars for other people while our country is $22 trillion in debt, while we have millions of people living in poverty in America still that need investments in infrastructure and need school choice. And we need to balance our budget at home, and we need a better focus on our own citizens. Instead of the idea, how is Iran right now getting in the direct aims and wants of people that are living in poverty in America? Now, of course, Iran could get there. They do fund terror all over the world, but they're not anymore because of the sanctions. So it's a matter of time. Our economy is booming. Their economy is failing. And so look, we need a future without endless conflict, and the president recognizes this. Let's cut to sound right now, Mr. Producer, on the president mentioning how strong countries do not fight endless wars.
Our brave troops have now been fighting in the Middle East for almost 19 years. In Afghanistan and Iraq, nearly 7,000 American heroes have given their lives. More than 52,000 Americans have been badly wounded. We have spent more than $7 trillion in fighting wars in the Middle East. As a candidate for president, I loudly pledged a new approach. Great nations do not fight endless wars.
That was the president right there at his campaign reelection announcement. See, the president has been consistent on this, that in order for a country to put the needs and wants of their citizens first, you must reject the elite political class that is happy to send our own citizens into war, that is happy to put another 10,000 Americans into Iran, which would be a horrible mistake. And let's play this out. Let's pretend we did go to war with Iran. Would we win? Of course we would win. Because we have the resolve, and we have the wealth, and we have the capacity, and we have the people. If we really needed to take over Iran for whatever silly reason that would be, we could take Tehran in a month. A lot of Americans would die, and a lot of money would be spent. I mean, you know how much those Tomahawk missiles cost? Millions of dollars each. Millions. But yeah, we could do it. We have the weaponry. We have the people. We have the wealth. But then what? We would be responsible for rebuilding the bridges, rebuilding the schools, and governing. The same mistake we made in Iraq, some people want us now to make in Iran. Are you not even close? Keep the pressure on Iran. Keep the sanctions up. Focus on our own country. Focus on the needs and wants of our own citizens, American people. Any sort of drums that are beating for war against Iran must be totally, wholeheartedly rejected. And I think we have to talk more honestly about the foreign policy failures of America. The foreign policy failures, such as the Iraq war, that was a total and complete mistake, such as overthrowing Masagde and putting the Shah back in place, which sowed the seeds of a lot of American resentment throughout the Middle East. And look, I'm not talking about going on an apology tour like Obama. I'm talking about being honest. I'm saying that we have to be honest that the war games that we've been playing, it might have sounded good in the early 2000s. It might have been like, yeah, we can change the world and we can create a new chapter in the Middle East. It cannot work. It does not work. The cultures are far too different, and American lives should not be continually being lost fighting for an impossible objective. And so the president is spot on here. The president has been heroic in rejecting the endless wars in the Middle East. He's withdrawn a lot of troops from the Middle East. He's been harshly critical of the kind of military-industrial complex. I talked about this in my new piece in The Telegraph, which is a London paper that got published last week, which the Iranians actually want conflict and the Iranians actually want war. And the president is not going to give them what they want. Instead, he's going to keep the pressure on, give assistance wherever possible to the people of Iran that are rising up against the dictators. And through this, we will finally see freedom win. It might not happen tomorrow. It might not happen in 5 years or 10 years. But through the process of attrition, the supreme leaders of Iran, they're worried they would not be shooting down drones and trying to bomb carriers in the Strait of Hormuz if that was not the case. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. I just felt that this episode was really important, given all the dynamics and misinformation around it. It's just so funny, Mr. Producer. Only President Trump could get the Democrats and all of a sudden support war. They're all saying, oh, he's indecisive. Make no mistake. The Trump presidency, the MAGA doctrine, if you will, which you might be hearing that phrase another time very soon with an upcoming book I have. The MAGA doctrine is one of putting our nation state first, of peace and prosperity, and objectively looking at failures where we had missteps in the past and not allowing that to happen again. The president is winning on all fronts, and a war with Iran would be a horrible, horrible choice. Please give us those 5 stars. Please subscribe to the Charlie Kirk Show. We totally and greatly appreciate your support of our program. Go down and ask us some questions. This episode we felt was really timely. We like doing flash episodes when the news kind of spikes up and we feel that we can contribute to the narrative, but we need your help. Please support ExpressVPN, the sponsor of this show. If you want to get involved with Turning Point USA, go to tpusa.com. Thank you so much for listening. Give us those 5 stars. Rate us every day if you can remember to do it. Subscribe. We'll be back with another episode of the Charlie Kirk Show soon. Thank you so much.
It was a crime no one expected. and one many can't forget.
They were brutalized.
22 Hours, An American Nightmare, a new podcast from WTOP News and Podcast One, details the heinous murders of a D.C. power couple, their 10-year-old son, and housekeeper inside their own home. The chilling messages from the victims being held hostage.
Hey, Nellie, it's Saba.
The complicated trail of evidence and shocking moments from the trial.
She thinks she knows how Darren Wink got inside the house.
His defense team drops a bombshell.
Will this investigation lead to the release of confidential audio recordings from the case?
So it's under general counsel review. I mean, I'm committing to making a transparent court.
22 Hours, An American Nightmare. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts today.